presentations, too, in addition to the bills. So we'll get started. First bill we'll visit this afternoon will be Senate File 828, Senator Higgins, the Safe Patient Handling Nurses Bill. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, we have an A6 delete all amendment if
okay, we'll pass
get
that
out to members,
we'll,
and if somebody would be so kind as to move it for me, please.
Mr. Chair.
Don't think we have a quorum quite yet, so we'll just work off it, and then we'll move it as soon as we get a quorum. So
okay.
We're working off the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, the A6 amendment is the result of a lot of conversations from folks, the advocates in the industry. I think that this is the most current version of what we've gotten people to be talking about. Mr. Chair, the A6 amendment would require that all healthcare facilities in the state adopt a written safe patient handling policy by January 1st of 2008. This will help achieve the goal of minimizing manual lifting of patients by nurses and other direct patient care workers by using safe patient handling equipment by January 1st of 2011. I know you have a large agenda today, and we're getting a little late start. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to turn it over to the folks who know this the best. To my left is Betty Shogren, and she is a registered nurse. And she and I have worked together on several other safe patient handling and other good bills to protect the workers. So I'll turn it over to Betty.
Good. Welcome to the committee. And always state your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Elizabeth Shogren, S-H-O-G-R-E-N, and I work for Minnesota Nurses Association as a specialist in occupational health and safety. I understand we have a time constraint here, so I'm going to get right to the point. The 2004 Minnesota Safety Report from the Department of Labor and Industry lists the top 14 occupations where occupational injuries exist. Of the 14, nursing assistants are number 2, RNs are number 7, and LPNs are number 12. And if you look at every aspect of that report, it essentially says that healthcare workers have higher rates of injury and more severe injury than other workers in the state. We have relied for 30 years on good body mechanics. There's scientific evidence that that never worked and it never will work. That evidence has been available to the employers in the state for 10 years, and yet we have not made a lot of progress in having a safe workplace implemented in relation to lifting equipment. And we still use people to do the work of machines. We've been very patient. As Senator Higgins said, we've worked together on other issues relating to lifting and mechanics in the past. We've been waiting 10 years for this to get better. I lost my job as a nurse at the bedside over 30 years ago. And there's very little change in the working conditions then and now. We would like to see a change, and we would appreciate the support of this committee as we go forward in trying to make the healthcare workplace a safer place.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, next is Stacy Lundgren. Stacy is a nurse from Bemidji.
My name is Stacy Lundquist, L-U-N-D-Q-U-I-S-T.
That's okay. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you very much for holding this hearing today. I am a registered nurse as well, but I will never work as a nurse again. In 2004, at the age of 50, and after working full-time for more than 20 years, I was diagnosed with a very serious back injury that ended my nursing career. It also ended any real employment anywhere. I was employed at North Country Regional Hospital in Bemidji, Minnesota, in the day surgery and post-anesthesia care unit. Nurses in these units were often required to transport post-surgical patients to other units to receive further care. Many of these patients were transported on a stretcher or a hospital bed, in which the weight being transported could easily exceed 300 to 800 pounds, respectively. If we were moving a heavy patient on a bed requiring equipment like oxygen tanks, monitors, and traction, those weights would increase the weight of that bed respectively. In most situations, it was necessary to push the stretcher or bed several hundred feet, and this always included multiple stops, starts, and turns. The floors were carpeted, which dramatically increased the resistance and made the task even more difficult. Prior to my injury, I had asked my employer to purchase a device that would help move the stretchers and beds. This device is similar to those used in parking lots to move grocery carts. The equipment cost $6,000, but my employer said it was too expensive. I asked for the device because it was extremely difficult to push heavy equipment and patients those long distances, and I believed my coworkers or I would be seriously injured. During my last week on the job, I needed to transport a 300-pound orthopedic patient on a bed with multiple other pieces of equipment from my unit to the floor, and this amount exceeded 800 pounds. I tried to get assistance but could only find one nursing assistant to help me. She and I pushed the bed through the halls, onto and off the elevator and over those carpeted floors. It took all we could to move that bed. Suddenly, I experienced severe pain, and I knew that something very bad had just happened to me. When my work was done, I went home and tried to relieve the pain, but nothing seemed to help. I went to work the next day and was unable to complete my shift. I returned a second time, and that day I was no longer to be able to get out of a chair or stand without severe pain. I went home, and I have never returned to work again. I've had four surgeries over the past 2.5 years. I suffer from severe chronic pain, which can only be controlled with medication. I can walk only short distances with a cane and must use a wheelchair when I leave my home. At times, this pain is so intense that I have told my husband I would rather be a paraplegic. I have lost my career.
Deep breath.
My injury fundamentally changed every part of my life. I can't go for a walk. I can't shop. I can't bike. I can't pitch a tent or camp or hike in the woods, which were all things I enjoyed. I can't sleep or rest without medication, and even then I can't sleep well. I couldn't pick up my first grandchild due to my weight restrictions. All of that could have been prevented if I had had one single piece of equipment. The data is clear. Every day we go to work, we risk injury because we don't have the necessary equipment to protect ourselves and our patients. With the current nursing shortage and aging workforce, employers cannot afford to be remiss any longer. The cost of my care, wage replacement, and disability rating is easily worth in excess of $200,000. The cost for my employer to replace me makes that number even higher. To his credit, once my employer saw what had happened to me, he took action and invested in a significant amount of equipment for the entire facility for approximately the same cost. And I applaud his actions to protect my colleagues. Unfortunately, it is too late for me. In addition to the physical and emotional consequences of my injury, I will lose well over $500,000 in future wages and more in lost retirement income. Work comp doesn't replace that income. It doesn't come close. The pain I endure every day may never end, and the rest of my life will never be what it could have been. I made a long and painful journey to come here today because I want you to see what happens when nurses and other healthcare workers do not have appropriate safety equipment.
And that's the only reason I'm in this wheelchair today. I know that my degree of injury may not be typical, but it is not unusual. There are other people like me. There are other nurses like me and other healthcare workers like me. I'm here to ask for your help, please. For every other person who takes care of people like all of you and your families when you need help. And I thank you again for holding this hearing today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have at the appropriate time.
Senator Scheidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Thank you for making that trip. I think it really helps us to understand how serious the issue is. I wonder, and maybe one of you said it, but it strikes me that it's even safer for patients.
It is.
If you have this equipment than if you should fall while you're trying to transfer someone or lift them. Is that?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask about lifting and transfer aids. It's interesting because just last night, Bob Woodruff, the man who suffered the incredible brain injury, in I don't know if anybody saw it on ABC, but it was an incredible story. And it showed a dad and a wife helping with the therapy, the rehab of one of the brain-injured veterans. And they didn't have any help, and they almost dropped him. And I couldn't help thinking, my sister works with home health care, and they use sometimes something that it's like a belt kind of thing or whatever. Would that fit into the lifting and transfer aids, or is this always mechanical? I mean, it seems to me that those things help in some way to distribute the weight better.
Mr. Chair.
Gentleman in the back, did you have an answer in the green shirt? It is.
It's kind of technical, Mr. Chairman, but I just wondered if it included that.
What
not the belts. No.
What equipment works?
Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joseph J. Austin. I'm the Director of Safety and Training for St. Louis County in northern Minnesota. For the past 18 months, I've been involved with putting a safe patient handling program in place at our 200-bed nursing home. To directly answer your question, Senator, the use of a gait belt is appropriate for some types of residents. Okay, but the type of device that you use, and specific to the gait belt, is for residents that have higher level, they have higher physical abilities. So you tailor the specific type of equipment that you're going to use to the abilities of the resident or patient that you have. I understand this is a business committee. If I could just have 30 seconds of your time. I drove down from Duluth.
Yeah, that's fine.
And he's on your list, I think.
You better get home. It's going to snow tonight.
I'll keep it very short and sweet. Like I said, over the last 18 months, I've been the driving force behind putting a program in at our nursing home. And I am here to testify that from a business standpoint, safe patient handling works. Prior to us having a program at our facility, you had a 50% chance of being injured if you were an aide per year at Chris Jensen. Since we've put our program in place, after our first year, we have seen a 75% reduction in transfer-related injuries. Based on OSHA estimates of costs associated with work-related injuries, specifically recordable injuries, we estimate that we will have a 1 to 2 year payback on every dollar spent at our facility. Our healthcare providers are being hurt on the job at very high rates, and safe patient handling represents a cost-effective solution to the problem.
Let me ask a question. I would guess you're right, there would be a payback on this stuff. Why do we need safety grant taxpayers' dollars to tell somebody to do this or tell the nursing homes or tell the industry, the hospitals, do it? Why do we have to give out grants for something that they probably should be doing?
Mr. Chair, the grants would be for the actual acquisition of the lifting devices.
Probably
you
still a good question. I don't know, but we'll talk about the money later, I guess, or somebody else will. But you know, it's something that I believe, and from the witnesses, should be done this way properly today. It will save money. But then, Mr. and Mrs. Hospital, here's $40,000 and $40,000 for you, and I just don't know. But anyway, that's probably the Finance Committee's. Ours is more policy, and I certainly have convinced me that we have to do something. But we have a quorum, Senator. Tomasoni moves the amendment.
The A6 amendment.
The A6 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay, do we have any more?
Mr. Chair, would you have two very quick testifiers, Sue Stout from the Hospital Association and Joel Euland from the MS Society?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Susan Stout. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. The Minnesota Hospital Association is supportive of Senate File 828 as it's been amended because we are aware of the new research that's available, which indicates that the prevention of injuries related to lifting is no longer an issue of learning to lift properly, but includes the proper use of lifting equipment. Hospitals wish to prevent injuries to their nursing staff and make the hospital a safer workplace. Now, I should tell you here that as a nurse myself, when I went to nursing school, I was taught all you have to do is use proper body mechanics and you'll never hurt yourself. And even up to actually now, there are some schools of nursing that still teach that. So the information about lifts is fairly new. And I think that Betty Shogren was absolutely right in that the data that's out now indicates that proper body mechanics isn't the solution. A number of hospitals have already established safety committees, purchased lifting equipment, and trained the staff on the proper use of this equipment. The North Country Health Services is a 116-bed unit or hospital in Bemidji, recently completed a large renovation project. As a part of the renovation, and I would add probably the learning in terms of what had happened to this nurse, as a part of that renovation, the hospital installed the state-of-the-art ceiling-mounted lifts for all patient rooms. The cost of installing the lifts and purchasing the motors to run the lifts in each room carried a price tag of about $600,000. That was the overall cost for one hospital. This was no small investment, and it was undertaken by the hospital because they believed this would decrease staff injuries and improve patient care. Over time, the hospital hopes that they will see injuries decrease, and I believe that they will. The hospital administrator believes that they will, and they believe that they'll see their work comp rates go down. But for now, the hospital is proud of the fact that they've moved forward and purchased the appropriate lifting equipment. Many hospitals, however, may not have the cash on hand to be able to undertake such a large project all at once. And we need to look at ways to phase in the use of lifting equipment and to achieve the goals established in this particular legislation. We're appreciative of the fact that the bill allows hospitals the flexibility to address this issue facility by facility through consultation with their employees, and that the amendment does not require the hospitals that have already made progress in this activity to start all over again. We strongly support the portions of the bill that provide the grant funding for the purchase of the equipment and for staff training, because without that grant funding, especially some of the very small hospitals that do not have that kind of cash flow, wouldn't be able to get started. Thank you.
Senator Scheid?
Ms. Jordan,
oh, you were okay.
No.
I thought I saw something. Did you have another witness, Senator?
Ms. Jordan?
Very quickly.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I represent about 9,000 people with multiple sclerosis. Of that number, about 15 to 20% of people with multiple sclerosis in Minnesota are using a wheelchair or a scooter on a consistent basis. And I think one of the challenges that we see for people with MS when they go into especially a clinic setting is that when they're going to try to be transferred onto an examination table, if there isn't staff available to be able to help do that transfer, that can significantly change just how the appointment goes for that person. For example, we know that a lot of two-thirds of people with MS in Minnesota are women, and yet we know quite a number are not getting pap smears because they are not able to be transferred onto the examination table. We're just getting regular checkups, being able to be transferred onto an MRI table for diagnostic work as it relates to multiple sclerosis. These are some of the stories that we've heard at our chapter from people, it's creating some problems, I think, because either the staff are unable to do it because there's not enough staff available at that particular time, or are unwilling sometimes to even use the equipment that may be available because they don't feel that they're properly trained on that. And so that's one of the reasons why we support this bill. And so I'd be able to stand for any questions.
Mr. Chair. Well, this to me seems long overdue, but
Mr. Chair, I had the opportunity to watch one of these mechanical lifts in action when my dad was in the nursing home at the end of his life. His roommate was about 6'5" and well over 300 pounds and had no use of his hands or legs. And two very small but strong women came in, and I thought, oh, my, how are they going to, get this gentleman into his wheelchair to go down for lunch that day? And somebody came in pushing a mechanical lift. And so I got to watch them actually position him, without strain to the worker. And clearly he was very comfortable with the idea of them using the lift. He had, I don't know whether he was originally very kind of apprehensive about it, but I think he knew he was going to be handled safely and appropriately, and that made all the difference. So I think, Mr. Chair, if
we probably need a motion
else,
to
state and local government, because there is rulemaking.
Oh, that's true too.
I'll move it. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
We're going to fight over who moves.
And you'll have a finance issue later.
Yes.
Too. Okay, on the Tomasoni motion to local. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you all very much.
That was wonderful testimony, too, from the witnesses there. And young lady there in the red, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. It's quite a story. Senator Sparks, are you ready with the plumbers?
You bet.
We're not dripping, but Senate File 618, Senator Sparks. Who's that guy with you there?
I got some help here, Mr. Chair.
It's a big help.
You bet.
Thanks for pointing that out, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, before we get started, I do have an author's amendment, the A4 amendment, that I'd like to put on the bill to get the bill in the shape we would prefer.
Yeah, please. Let's do that. On the A4 Sparks amendment, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 618 before you today. This has been a work in progress, and I'm glad that we're able to reach a compromise. We did have some testifiers, but in the essence of time, I think we will hand out a letter of support. The bill has many supporters, the Association of Building Contractors, the Mechanical Contractors Association, and the Plumbing and Heating Cooling Contractors are supportive of the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Johnson to walk you through the bill.
I welcome Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dave Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Pipe Trades. What I think I'll do is I'll briefly describe the bill and then answer any questions that anybody might have about it. Currently in Minnesota, electricians, well drillers, septic tank installers, landscapers, and building contractors are all licensed throughout Minnesota. And they can't operate their business without meeting state standards. The only group that currently is not licensed state lot-wide is plumbers. And we think it's an important kind of exception in the sense that these are the folks that are most responsible for delivering safe water to people's homes. The anomaly in the law goes back to the 1930s at a time when, you know, most people in greater Minnesota and outside of cities of 5,000 didn't have, you know, centralized water and some of the things they have today. And so what the Senate file before you does basically is try to correct that anomaly and then put in a grandfather provision to allow those individuals who are currently licensed with the department as unlicensed bonded contractors to kind of bridge in to having a plumber's license. That's kind of the basis of the bill. We think it's a good consumer protection measure in that right now folks don't have to have insurance, and there are other things that they don't have to have to be a plumber in outstate Minnesota. I think the letter you have references a situation in the Star Tribune from last year about some of the problems that can arise. As Senator Sparks said, we have broad support from the groups that he mentioned. The Minnesota Pipe Trades is primarily a labor organization, a group of labor groups, but the ABC, which is non-union folks, supported as well. And I guess what I would ask is the committee's indulgence just to bring up Bob Hesse for a couple minutes as he brought someone from outstate Minnesota to talk a little bit about it. And then we can stand for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Heise, H-E-I-S-E. I'm president of the Minnesota Associated Builders and Contractors. We represent 400 contractors around the state that employ approximately 22,000 employees. One of our largest special interest groups are mechanical contractors, including plumbers. The good part of our membership is merit shop contractors. We support statewide credentialing for all plumbers for genuine consumer safety as long as it does not unnecessarily restrict or impede competition in the market. We believe credentialing can be good for the industry and, more importantly, for the consumer. Just a couple quick points on why we think this is a good idea and why you might want to consider some specific points. Point number one, a well-managed and neutral code inspection system must be a priority moving forward to assure compliance with building codes and safe construction. Any credentialing needs to be statewide in scope. Testing should be valid and secure and should include all municipalities and townships across the state. No local government entity should supersede state credentialing in this construction trade. And lastly, before I introduce a particular contractor who's joining me today, it is important that the construction industry convey to the public and to the customer that we are safe, competent, and reputable. Credentialing all plumbers can be very positive in promoting our image and business practices. Today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have Dave Burdan, who's the owner of Jaybird. They're out of St. Cloud, Minnesota, and he just wants to share with you some of his thoughts. Dave?
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee as well. I'm here with ABC today and also as a plumbing contractor. And while I'm probably not usually in favor of expanding government regulation, I believe this would be a good bill for Minnesota. In the short term, it won't affect anybody's livelihood that's going to be required to get a license by grandfather, they're grandfathering in existing people that are working in the trade. And in the long term, it will help to ensure that plumbing is installed in a quality and safe fashion so as not to cause problems for homeowners and probably more importantly for future homeowners who buy some, who are buying existing existing housing. And maybe just to put it in a little different perspective, my dad was a plumber, was a town plumber in Sleepy Eye, a town of under 5,000 people 40 years ago, and he could never understand why the safety and quality and health of the people in those homes was less important than those that own homes in towns larger than 5,000. To me, that kind of just makes it all make sense. Thank you.
Any further questions of
Mr. Chair, can I just make one last point, which is the amendment represents our discussions with the Department of Labor and Industry about the concerns they had. So we did consult with them, and I think we addressed all the concerns they raised, which was in the amendment that Senator Sparks adopted.
Where did we find that grandfathered in stuff? Was there language like that?
That would be in Section 2. By the amendment, what that provides is that the restricted plumbing license will allow those people who are currently registered with the department basically a bridge into a full license.
Okay, I see it now. Yeah. Okay, yeah, very good. Senator Sparks, did you have any?
Mr. Chair, I do have an additional amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay, you or somebody can explain the amendment while it's being passed out.
Mr. Chair, this is an amendment that was brought to me by the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, and the new language will allow for the continuation of a practice set forth in a consent decree with the Department of Health and a settlement of litigation in 1998. Simply, what the amendment would do would codify the statute of these longstanding practices that were put into place in 1998.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, is it drawn to the original bill or is it drawn to the amendment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I could ask for counsel's help, but I believe it's to the original bill.
Oh, the first one wasn't to delete everything. I'm sorry. It's the original bill. Got it.
Okay, everybody. Concerned about this legislation is okay with A1, is it kind of correct?
That's my understanding, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Correct.
We're not ever excluding anybody in this process. If somebody in the audience wants to concern, you just let me know and you can speak for or against these issues. If not, on this one, Senator Sparks will move the A1 amendment.
I would move the A1 amendment then, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Any further discussion?
That's the end of my
just kind of puts the plumbers and with everybody else, I mean, with the labor and industry and the statewide licensing, the way I understand it. Okay. Okay. Any further discussion on the bill as amended? Two times.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding after talking with counsel that the bill should be re-referred to Senator Tomasoni's Economic Budget Division due to the fact that there is a $90 fee that was put in on the amendment. So I believe the correct motion, if counsel would agree with that, would be that Senate File 618 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Economic Budget Division.
Finance. I think it's got to go to the Finance Committee.
I'm sorry.
And then,
okay. And then eventually we'll get there. Okay.
All right, that's the motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah,
thank you, Mr.
Very good.
Chair.
Yep, no problem. We're going to get into, at this point, some good discussion on all of this energy stuff that
legislation we've been talking so much about and the exploding industry in Minnesota, particularly now with the mandates, the 2025 mandates and other things we're doing here in the state of Minnesota to be in the forefront of this whole energy issue. And they tell me this could be a multi-billion dollar industry going forward, and that some of the bills we're going to be hearing deal with financial issues, deal with the job training issues, and just it goes on and on and on what's going to come out of this $10 to $20 billion emerging, exploding energy issues. So I'm not sure how to – well, first of all, we're going to hear from Mike Bull, Assistant Commissioner of Department of Commerce, who's been – where is he?
Oh, he's not here. We could ask for Teresa to come.
I see he stepped out, but we could kind of – Teresa and Spath, Dr. Eldy. I wanted the committee to – here's why we want to hear from these folks, because they've been working on this whole energy thing for quite a while, as a lot of people, but they're trying to put all the pieces together, if you will. And I met with these folks, and I said, you better come and tell us what you're doing, because we don't want duplicating things, and maybe some of these bills we're looking at might be married. So anyway, why don't you guys just, I don't know, can you do something in 5 or 10 minutes, and then
sure.
We're going to have you back for a whole hearing.
Okay.
Okay, but give us a little overview. I was excited to see what the things you're doing, and I quite frankly wasn't aware that they were happening, and that's the purview, if you will, or one of them, of this jobs and business committee. So what that's enough said by me, but go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Teresa Spath, and I'm the Executive Director of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and I have with me here today Dr. Robert Eldy, Dean of the College of Biological Sciences at the University of Minnesota.
Let me just interrupt. These folks aren't going to tell the whole story here today, okay? It's so exciting that at least pay attention. To me it is. For the 5 minutes, and then we're going to have, I'll repeat myself, but a full-blown hearing. It's good stuff. It's good stuff and the whole energy thing. And
okay, you get 2.5
That's, what did I give you, 4.5 minutes or 5? I'm taking 5 of your Okay, but go ahead. This is good stuff. Let me just say that again.
What we wanted to share with you today, to kind of boil things down in a nutshell, several months ago you might be aware that there was a proposal that came out, or a request for proposals from the Department of Energy to create a bioenergy center in Minnesota. And I will let Dr. Eldy address that a little bit, but by virtue of trying to pull the state together on a proposal like that, we started holding, ARI did with a USDA grant that we received in renewable energy, what we call the bioenergy roundtable. And what you see here in front of you, I hope that you all have an example. This is a synthesis of what we've been doing since September. Basically, what we found out is the issue is much larger than creating a research and development center in Minnesota, although that is extremely critical. There are many, many issues that came together, and what we did is we pulled together about 38 organizations that deal in some fashion in renewable energy and that we consider to have expertise. And when we say that, anything from the University of Minnesota, Minsky Institutions, ARI, Minnesota Technology Incorporated, and several of the state agencies, including Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Commerce, and Department of Employment and Economic Development, we came together and identified issues and opportunities in renewable energy across the state of Minnesota. To kind of make a long story short right now, what you see before you is a group of once we synthesized the over 1,000 ideas that came forward from all of these organizations, we've kind of brought it down to 5 main categories of issues that need to be addressed. You see those before you.
This one here.
What we found is there are 5 main categories: economics and financing, public policy and public awareness, talent development, a broad incumbency, including workforce development, but maybe even larger issues than that, breakthrough research, and infrastructure. And what we are intending to do, our next quarterly meeting is held on March the 20th, and it will be here in St. Paul at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And in December, we threw the ideas out, kind of came together with the main themes. March 20th, what we will be doing is meeting with those 38 organizations and possibly more now to discuss the action steps. We have all the ideas on paper now and a cohesive document, and we're going to start making plans for how do we implement and make sure that Minnesota stays the leader in renewable energy. And with that, I'll give Dr. Eldy a few minutes to comment as well, because he had a significant role into pulling some of this information together.
Welcome, Dr. Eldy, to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Eldy. I serve as Dean of the College of Biological Sciences and Chair of the University's Initiative in Renewable Energy and the Environment that was funded by action in the 2003 session, which essentially was a set-aside of Xcel Energy ratepayers' resources to fund $20 million of research at the University of Minnesota. And I'm very pleased and have testified before a couple of committees about some of the progress we've made with that. But I'm really here today to report that as a consequence of coming together under the umbrella that has just been illustrated with this diagram, we submitted, in response to the Department of Energy's request for proposals, the largest grant proposal ever submitted from the University of Minnesota for anything. And that was a $125 million proposal to create one of two, it's a very intense competition, one of two centers of bioenergy research in the country. And I'm pleased to say that that was a really wonderful coalition of people from the University of Minnesota system-wide, coordinate campuses, from its experiment stations, from several Minsky system institutions, including prominently Bemidji State, Mankato State, the White Earth Tribal Community College, and others. It also included OWRI as a prominent partner. It also includes entities like the Science Museum of Minnesota, the Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center. So this is a part or a taste of what we can do together. And I think what we're committed to as the statutorily created institutions in the state of Minnesota is bringing together the talent and the potential that we have to serve the state better than we could do so alone. And so we'll have an opportunity, as I understand, Chairman, that we will come and present a more comprehensive assessment of where we are and what we need to do to get to where we need to be. But in a nutshell, we're giving you a thumbnail state of the art update to where we think we can steer this great coalition of stakeholders in the renewable energy space in Minnesota.
Well, you certainly zeroed in. I mean, the infrastructure, the breakthrough research, the talent development, which is educational development, public policy, and certainly economics and financing. I mean, are there going to be tax incentives, or are there going to be grants, or are there going to be some things like SBA guaranteed loans to get into this stuff. So I think they've hit the nail on the head on all of the key ingredients to this whole renewable energy issue, and that's why I think it's really exciting. And some of the bills we're hearing later on kind of play on all of this. So I think there's some kind of, hopefully there's a way to pull, I don't know if it's in this committee or where, to pull some of these ideas together and make a very good comprehensive thing. Because, again, so I would guess, they tell me it's a multi-billion-dollar business going forward. Should we train our good people in bio and then they get shipped out to another state, which is happening? Do we have to build a windmills in some other nation? And I'm saying we ought to build them here, not assemble them here, for example. And these are the kinds of things, collectively, us as senators and other people pull this stuff together. And it's going to take a combination of educational tools, certainly financial. And we don't have the answers today, but somebody's going to put out, well, I won't get into it, but it could be patterned, like I said earlier, after an SBA loan where the local bankers aren't going to, So anyway, that's part of it. But that's why I thought this is good stuff. And with that, I think that's a good Mr. Bull, are you here? He's going to give us just a little bit. I don't know if he's going to expand on this stuff. But before we get into the actual bill, Senator Rosen, any quick questions of these folks here?
Yes, Mr. Chair,
I have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Aldi, is the departments involved in this collaboration of all these entities, like the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency or the DNR, very crucial part, crucial elements in as far as making sure that these projects
That's a good question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, a very good question. I mean, I think what Mr. Michael Bull can say is on behalf of at least some of the departments that are crucially involved at a regulatory and financing stage, yes, the answer is yes, but it may be good if we if the 5 minutes were extended another minute or so.
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Bull, the Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I apologize for not being here a moment ago. I was
all right. You're here now.
I am here now. I just want to maybe speak briefly to Senator Rosen's question, and the answer is Department of Commerce and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture are intertwined in this process in a leadership role. And my job is to make sure that the PCA, DNR, DEED, and the other state agencies that aren't specifically pulled in, that they're coordinated with and they understand what the directions are. I think we could talk offline to make sure that your any issues that you have are being addressed as this moves forward. But, Mr. Chair, one thing I wanted to point out to the committee is that the ideas that these folks are working on and that you guys will be talking about today, taking a comprehensive view of the economic development potential of our energy policy, specifically our renewable energy policy, we haven't done that in any comprehensive way in any administration as far as I'm aware. And, you know, we're talking, as you just pointed out, Mr. Chair, we're talking about the manufacturing, local ownership of projects, construction of projects, the maintenance service of the projects as they're out there, the financing of projects. I was going to say workforce development, but apparently I'm told now it's talent development that is the term, and research. And taking this comprehensive view is what's going to be necessary, I think, to maximize and capture the benefits of the renewable energy standard that we just that you all just passed and the governor signed, and our other renewable energy programs that we have. We've focused in the past on public policy for promoting local ownership of energy production, wind projects in particular, and the farmer-owned cooperative ethanol plants in particular, and capturing energy dollars to local economies. But we haven't taken that broader view of all the various aspects that we just discussed, all the various piece parts of that, of putting together a project and making it happen and capturing all the benefits. And I think that's what's important about what these guys are doing, as well as what a number of the bills that you're about to hear are focused on as well.
Well, that's exactly right. We need a comprehensive, and we need what I would call a roadmap, how to get there. And as long as we're the top state now in mandates, if you will, we ought to be the top state in producing the products to get us there.
I agree.
You know, the bio and the wind and what have you, and the turkey.
Mr. Chair, one
thing. Why not be? I mean, we got to be out front and not just telling everybody what to do or to get there. We got to create those jobs.
Absolutely.
Those good jobs right here at home with this multi-billion-dollar business going forward. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make this analogy of a hearing that we had several weeks ago with biotechnology and how we really, truly did not have, we hadn't a clue what was in the state until the Bio Alliance came along and they started working on it. So my question to you, Mr. Bull or Dr. Eldia, have you included the bioscience group or the Bio Alliance group, biotechnology groups?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes. The Bio Business Alliance and Dell Wallstrom is a very close partner in another piece of this work that we're working on. And actually, and Teresa could probably talk about it in more detail, but they're sponsoring some economic development modeling with Sandia National Labs, working with AURI, to figure out where the biggest bang for our buck is. And it goes directly to what I think Senator Dahl's bill is looking at as well. So I think that'll be very helpful.
And Mr. Chair.
Rosa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to say that I think it's truly important to get all the players at the table like you've done to figure out exactly what this roadmap is, because the potential, as you said, Mr. Chair, is just amazing in the state. We've set the cornerstone, but now we have to build off of that, and it's very important to make sure we do it and do it right.
Yeah, we got a good shot at it now. Dr. Eldy, did you wish to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, if I could just add to that. You know, I think the beauty of what is happening here with these coalitions is that working with the BioBusiness Alliance, they're looking at this Destination 2025 and trying to outline landmarks and milestones along the way to 2025, including what you might call this white or green biotechnology, mm-hmm. In their parlance. And I think what we're looking at in addition with this coalition is, what do we do right now? So it's a combination. It's not waiting for the ultimate blueprint, but knowing that there are things that we ought to be doing right now and getting that that up and operating. And then working closely with BioBiz to be in lockstep on this long-term vision.
Mr. Chair,
Rosa.
Just one more comment, please. I just can't stress enough how important it is to make sure that all the agencies are at the table and are all communicating, and that they understand how important this is when it comes to the permitting and the regulations. And I think we all know what I'm referring to. But we definitely have to be talking the same talk and making it work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All of the above, Senator Rosen, you're right on. Employment department there, I mean, this is thousands of jobs out there, you know, coming forward, and we better take advantage of that. And all right, I appreciate the brief. We'll get you back, and we'll have a good or longer hearing. Senator Anderson, are you?
I'm just looking at you.
Yeah, see, now this one really fits right in, too, Senator Anderson's, yeah. To the whole equation. And you heard some of our...
I'm just looking at you.
Come on up. And John and Tom, do you want to come up, too?
Welcome to the committee, Senator. It's Senate File 1244, Rural Wind Development Assistance.
I don't even have the number. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You had a really good discussion that will set the stage for what I want to propose today with this bill. Obviously, I think just about everyone in this room was a supporter of the renewable energy bill. I think all of us were. And it's very exciting what this means for our state. And one of the things, we've heard a lot of estimates about what this will mean for the future of our state. And I think conservatively we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of investment to meet the mandates and the requirements of that law to get to those high levels of wind that we need. There's going to be billions of dollars spent developing wind projects, building wind turbines, buying wind turbines, and constructing them, and all the associated kinds of work that goes along with that, construction, engineering, and technology. And we've had a lot of discussion in the Energy Committee about how to maximize those dollars and that benefit in our state so that we're not just importing wind turbines from around the world, as you said, Mr. Chair, and so that a lot of these projects, to the maximum extent we can, are owned by Minnesotans and have dollars recirculating in rural communities rather than just being sent to independent developers from far, far away. So we want to do everything that we can to try to maximize the economic development potential of our renewable energy industry, which we are going to see grow exponentially in the next couple of decades. And so this goes a little bit outside. We've had in our seabed bill, we've had policy mechanisms to try to encourage Minnesotans to be able to participate and own, have ownership of wind projects. This is another approach to that, to try to help provide assistance and support so that ordinary Minnesotans can compete with the big guys and try to, you know, get into the marketplace of wind development, which is getting to be a very competitive marketplace. And, you know, for example, some of the largest wind developers, the international and national companies, buy up lots of the wind turbines, and regular Minnesotans just can't even get access to them. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, and I've always said I think there's enough wind to go around. Everybody should have lots of opportunity to participate. But we want to try to maximize it for Minnesotans, and this will just provide assistance. So the idea of this bill is to set up a program that will provide that assistance in a very concrete way for Minnesotans who want to get involved in wind development. And it will provide technical, legal, financial assistance and provide a mechanism to try to pool resources so that individual farmers or community members can put their try to pool a project together, pool their resources, and compete for the wind turbines and for the other pieces of the technology and the workforce that will be needed to get these high levels of wind development built. So there's a lot of interest in this bill. I have three people who would like to speak on the bill, and I'll just let them testify. I don't need to say a lot more. I think the bill's pretty self-explanatory. We want to create a program. We're asking for an appropriation, which would come out of my budget division, and we're asking the organization that, you know, we want some this to be created and to come up with a significant private match. And my view is that this would ultimately be self-sustaining, and so that this would be a biennial, one-time appropriation from this biennium. And in the future, someone who proposes doing this is going to have to figure out how to a way to make it self-sustaining over the long run, whether through fees, through private foundations, through utility support, whatever it is. There's a lot of different possibilities out there. So I think it's something the state needs to kick it off, and then I think it hopefully will take off and have a life of its own.
Yeah, that's always been a concern of mine, that it seems like the big ones get bigger, and then we can't get out there and help the little folks, too, to get some of this action and be part of it, Minnesotans. But anyway, that's what I believe you're attempting to do here. We're going to do.
And Paula McAbee is here representing Windustry, and we have John Gostovich representing Fresh Energy and Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union, and they all have a lot more expertise than I do about some of the barriers that people face in trying to be wind developers when they're ordinary Minnesotans and farmers and community members.
Very good. Paula?
My name is Paula McAbee, and I'm a consultant to Windustry, and our executive director, Lisa Daniels, is out of town again working on wind issues. And I think, Mr. Chair, you and Senator Anderson really put the issue in focus that what's happening in the wind industry is a huge development, but if we don't do something to make sure that smaller people have a chance, have some space on that playing field, the large players are likely to take the majority of the benefits. Our policy consultant just came back from the Wind Power Finance and Investment Summit in California just a couple weeks ago. And what everyone at that conference was talking about is the cost of wind turbines has increased by about 60% in the last 2 years. And the rapid growth in the demand without a commensurate growth in supply has meant that sometimes people who want to put up turbines have to wait as long as 2 years in order to get access. And the wind industry now is rapidly consolidating. Mid-sized developers have bought out many of the small developers, and now the mid-sized developers are seeing pressure for further consolidation. And so large wind developers, as Senator Anderson was saying, are buying up the expertise, they're reserving the turbines, and sometimes they're even buying up the wind rights. Some of the larger developers are bragging that they have 8,000 megawatts, quote-unquote, in the pipeline. In other words, they're getting a hold of it before local or smaller developers or people who live in the rural communities can get the benefit. And what Senator Anderson is proposing, we believe, at Windustry is going to help level the playing field so that smaller investors, local community members, can work together, can form limited liability corporations or cooperatives, can work in partnership with their township or their county and can develop wind energy where the main benefits, the assets, the ownership will return back to the community and have the multiplier effect. Windustry has been providing this kind of technical assistance since mid-1990s. And if you go to their website, which is www.windustry.org, you'll see the fruits of some of this, that there are just basic information materials, know your wind, know your business, know your economics, that can give people the introduction on how to even start considering how to get benefit from windy areas. And then if you go a little deeper in the website, there is what I discovered, a 108-page worksheet, so that if you have information about your wind resource and your financial and your cost of capital, you can begin to determine what the economics are. Just looking at this, and I've been advised that Windustry is getting 1,500 hits on that website a day with an average of 12 pages. So people are not looking at it just casually, but they're looking to try and find information on how to make a wind project real. And that number of hits is continuing to increase. And Windustry is getting about 100 calls a month. Now, clearly, there are people who are looking for help in figuring out their wind resources, figuring out their economics, figuring out how do you deal with FERC, the regulatory environment at the federal level, how do you create a pool of capital so that you can begin to undertake this process. And this bill would go a long way into making that happen. Also, just to give you an idea of the cost, just to do a feasibility analysis to look at what are your wind resources, cash flow, your business analysis, could cost about $50,000. So that's a pretty big initial hurdle to start for a smaller project or a small group of farmers to look at. And transmission analysis, which is necessary if you're going to hook up any kind of wind turbine into the electric grid, can cost anywhere from $50,000 to more than $100,000. And so what we're hoping is that this bill will move forward and will help some of the smaller players get over these market barriers so that they can begin to develop community-based energy to fulfill the obligations in the renewable energy standard. And I'd be happy, just a couple stories. Maybe one quick story. Windustry has worked with cities, some of the initial community-based projects. For example, Worthington Public Utilities, they'd expressed interest. They didn't know how to start. And Windustry helped put together a how-to book for smaller communities to do community wind projects. And then the community formed a 17-member task force to analyze the issues and then worked with Windustry to hire a consultant, Tom Wind, to help look at how do they get into the objectives and how do they actually set up the project. And as a result, Worthington Public Utilities partnered with Missouri River Energy and Wisconsin Public Power, and they installed six turbines at about 5.5 megawatts. So that if there's some front-end help with its how-to and consulting, there have been many success stories. And Minnesota right now, approximately 26% of the installed wind has been community wind. And as the renewable energy standard steps that up, this kind of bill will help us make sure that Minnesotans retain the benefits of the renewable energy standard.
Yeah, you'd think with the renewable energy standards that the mandates, if you will, the 2025 stuff, and the demand is growing so fast in our state alone, you'd think they'd manufacture these things up on the range somewhere where, you know, with the cost of shipping and being 2-3 years behind. I mean, what does it cost to bring all the product over? You'd think that would be
tens of thousands of dollars.
Cost prohibitive, and why can't we build these things? Not put them together here, build them here. Not put together parts, but build them. Well, but anyway, go ahead. Wait,
Mr. Chair, just to respond to that, remember the Gamesa plant, we always talk about this when we were debating the renewable energy standard. They considered building a plant up north, and Pennsylvania got it. And it's a Spanish company that was building a turbine manufacturing plant. And one of the reasons they cited was that Pennsylvania had a standard. Well, now they're going to be saying Minnesota is the place because we have the best standard in the country. So they are going to that's going to happen.
That's why Deed and everybody's got to get out there. Yep. And that's why we have to have a package.
Yes.
We're all on the same roadmap. And go ahead.
This is such an exciting whole issue that I just can't control myself. But, I mean, this is the big dynamic future. This, the nation and the country and on and on and on, but the state of Minnesota, we got to be out in front.
Well, Mr.
That's
Chair,
why we're here today talking. So
yeah,
Senator
Rosen.
I'm
excited about it, too.
Mr. Chair, I love your enthusiasm.
This is good stuff.
I haven't seen you this excited in a long time. My question is to Ms. McAbee about how would you make a school situation work as far as putting a wind turbine on a school location that with this particular bill? I mean, it just fascinates me because actually I do have some school districts down in my district, which is perfect for wind, that are interested in doing something.
A couple of campuses have already...
Wyzetta.
They've
been trying, Mr. Chair. I met with Wyzetta the other day, and they said they got a grant from the Renewable Development Fund. The price of the turbines went up, and they never were able to do it. And we're trying to figure out, there is a Commerce Department program. Senator Rosen, you and I worked on that language last year, and it sort of died with the part on the energy bill that died last year, but I'm bringing it back. And so, but we need to figure out how to provide more assistance. But there's no reason why a school in Minnesota would not be able to take advantage of this assistance program. That's exactly what it could be used for. I mean, we mentioned schools and hospitals and community institutions as part of the benefit we're seeking to get is to all of those.
Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Thank you. Did you have another witness, Senator Tomasoni? We're going to get Ed Bach will give some tax credits up there.
Mr. Chairman?
You guys talk.
Senator Bach.
A lot more exciting to spend money than raise it.
Well, you're probably pretty good at both.
No. Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Senator Anderson, did you have it? Senator Tomasoni?
Is part of this advertising? Is that what I'm seeing back here?
I don't think we contemplate advertising out of this program, but that's definitely what DEED, we want DEED to be working on trying to promote our state, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, I don't know, it looks like reducing risk and increasing public support for transmission investment and lowering the market risk facing potential wind investors by supporting local wind development from start to finish. Sounds like advertising to me. I'm just wondering if that's what that is.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm John Gostovich, and I spent a lot of time sitting where John Fuller's sitting in the House of Representatives, and it's really a treat to be back. When we're talking about reducing risk and creating market opportunities, we're talking about an institution that can deliver very concrete services that add value and assistance to community-scale wind developers. In terms of making transmission palatable and welcome in a community, because in this state we have quite a history of opposing large transmission projects. If a county board, if a school district, if a group of farm investors realize that the transmission infrastructure that's going to be built is being built so that they can sell their energy at a fair price to a purchasing utility, the hope is that the transmission in the community will be seen as an asset that's providing value rather than a liability. So it's
advertising.
It's not advertising. It's word of mouth. It's getting political support from county boards, town councils, and it's helping communities see wind energy as a shared resource which is generating significant income. So this is making money. This is not spending money.
Mr. Chair, is any of the this is one of these. You can take a guess at this one, but when the Gamesa people were in my office and wanted a renewable energy standard, I said to them, "Well, if we give you a renewable energy standard, are you going to raise the price of the cost of windmills?" And so I'm just wondering if, because now that they know we need them, is that one of the reasons that the windmills are 60% more expensive?
Probably has a lot to do with exploding worldwide demand. The same thing is happening with photovoltaic cells. And until the industry ramps up with significant investments in new manufacturing capacity, there will be this upward price pressure on turbines. But remember, each turbine company is competing with its neighbor. So they want the sale, and to the extent possible, they will invest in manufacturing so that their equipment is not only the best, but the most cost-effective. So I think prices will go down. That happens in lots of similar industries.
So, Mr. Chairman, so this seems counterintuitive to me than what this bill is trying to do, because it seemed like the manufacture of lots of windmills would be the way to get the price down. And if we're going to have small companies who don't have a lot of money buying windmills, it's going to be expensive as opposed to, and I'm not trying to promote big companies here, but it would seem like the big companies would probably still have the advantage of getting the most cost-effective rate out of the cost of windmills, because they'd be purchasing more. So when you purchase just a few, that would most likely drive the cost up
to the small. A few wind turbines, they're pretty expensive. But if the institution that Senator Anderson is anticipating with this legislation gets on the ground, and I think it can, this is not about studying things, this is about doing rural economic development. It's an aggregator. And if it can take a number of local 20-megawatt projects and combine them into one 200-megawatt package, not only will it be easier and cheaper to sell that chunk of energy to purchasing utilities, but if you've got a 200-megawatt development looming on the horizon, wind turbine builders will be a lot more interested in talking to you and committing their resources and in putting together a contractual commitment to deliver.
I think that's one of the things that
I think this bill does to help smaller community-scale wind developers operate more cost-effectively, more efficiently.
I think there's another thing, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that the price aspect is already being governed by power purchase agreements. And what we found so far in Minnesota is that the community-based energy power purchase agreements are coming in at competitive rates. So that there is the place where it matters is, what is the customer paying? What are we paying for electricity? And community-based energy is not necessarily more expensive. It may be because the farmers are closer to it and they're able to, in some ways, reduce their appetite for profit as compared to someone who has several levels of middlemen. But the price is still, for energy, is still competitive. The rates that are being negotiated for community-based energy stay in the community, but they're not necessarily higher prices. And so this approach both lets some of the smaller players get over the barriers to market entry and also provides the potential that there would be some collaboration and consolidation to be able to get access to turbines at a reasonable price, which is the value of people working together.
Okay, do you have another, sir, did you wish to?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tom Peterson, and I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I also say I live on a farm in Pine County, and I've been driving to the Capitol every day for 20 years, or St. Paul. And I think one thing that's interesting is the amount of turbines we do see on, the blades on 35 coming down on the flatbeds, especially
there you
in
go
the summertime.
You better get home tomorrow morning.
I know. I'm behind the guy from Duluth. So, but I really appreciate Senator Anderson bringing this bill forward, because I happened to have a conversation with her a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the renewable electricity standard. And I said the one thing that's been really interesting, probably in the last 3-4 months, is the amount of calls I get personally at Farmers Union from members asking or telling me they're going forward with some kind of project, whether it's a individual project, whether it's a co-op or a LLC, or they're part of a seabed type project or a school or something. And, you know, I always say, too, in agri-news today, it's everywhere. At the one of the headlines is renewable energy gets Farmers Union's attention. And that's the big ag publication here in the state. And, again, we had a hearing here on seabed, about 2 weeks ago, kind of informational hearing. I walked in the room, and I was surprised how many of our members I saw in here who just came up to watch for the information. And so that's what I'm saying, is that the need's there. The bill says, like I said, that it could return back, because it says, you know, help increase the income of local residents. That's important. And I also say, too, by having this kind of technical assistance or support, it helps me in saying, here's where you call. A lot of times we say call industry or call the university, work with these different people. It's tough, though, to know exactly who to send people to. And I also say that there's times when some of the people I talk to, I'm not an expert, but I'll say maybe that project shouldn't be built. So that is another thing to consider, too, is there's kind of like a, you know, maybe even a gold rush coming in wind development, that this also plays an important role in that. And I would also mention, too, we've worked with the Farmers Legal Action Group here in St. Paul for some of the information, and they're developing a farmer's guide to wind energy so that it'll have a lot of the legal experts and opinions on that. So I appreciate that, and I urge your consideration for this bill because I definitely see a need for it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's any further discussion? Senator Rosen, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, you said the turbines are coming down 35. Are they coming in off the Great Lakes?
Mr. Chair, you know, when we were, and Senator Rosen, when we were considering this bill last year, I used to carry around with me the official publication of the Port Authority of Duluth. And what they said is they're exporting a lot less grain, but they're importing one of their biggest increases they've had. So it's good for Duluth and good for the port is the blades and the nose cones that are coming over from Germany and Denmark, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Spain, India, Denmark.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on that. I think it's fascinating. It'd be more appropriate and wonderful if they were manufactured up north where there is that ability to do that. The people are there. The affordable housing is there. In Senator Vickerman's district, I believe it's Ruslan?
Suzlon,
thank you. Ruslan is Senator Neville's L.A. Suzlon. And an issue for them was the housing. Mm. So a lot of the employees were coming over from Sioux Falls. Well, that's halfway there, but it's not all the way there. So it'd be great to have everything manufactured in, as you said, Mr. Chair, in Minnesota and preferably up north where we have the manpower.
Mr. Chairman, there was $750,000 in the bonding bill for a wind energy park in Virginia last year, so we're ahead of the curve on this.
Are you building that, Mr. Chair?
That's what it's for, yeah.
Is that the two combined? Two cities? Or is that just the one?
Virginia.
Or just Virginia.
But Mr. Chair, I know I've talked with national wind industry leaders who say what they're looking for is the knowledge that they will have a stable marketplace and looking for the signals from places, from different states, that the market will be there. And that's what we've done. The legislature has given that signal loud and clear, and so I think that they will be coming.
We've done it. You've done it.
Let's go.
Yeah, a lot of people around here. That's all right. Where does this go now?
I think probably Senator Solon would want to see this bill.
Yeah, that's correct. So Energy has asked for it. So Senator Carlson moves to this bill, and we refer it to the Energy Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you
very
much.
Good stuff. Yeah.
Senator Clark. I know you didn't mind sitting. You learned so much more now about energy.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a very exciting,
exciting stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. A lot of people put a lot of work and energy into the energy bill. How's that? You got it, didn't you? Okay, welcome. We have before us Senate File 165. Senator Clark, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have a couple handouts if we can have somebody do that. Actually, building off the last bill that you were talking about, I think we have an exciting opportunity in front of us. I'm here to talk about a partnership with the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, six of which are around the state of Minnesota. These foundations were established in the late 1980s, you might remember, through McKnight, and they have been a great source of a lot of economic development throughout greater Minnesota. Now, in the past, our state role has been, hi, Madam Chair, to provide matching funds for business lending administered by the initiative foundations. These investments have made Minnesota strong. They've repaid us countless time over in terms of jobs and economic activity throughout Minnesota. The foundations are coming to us now with a request which will allow them to expand on their business development work. And based on the bill you just heard and thinking about the possibilities between bioscience, applied bioscience, and a whole bunch of other kinds of things, I think that you can see that there's a lot of opportunities that may need some help. This request is rather unique. In order to expand their business finance activity, the initiative foundations are not actually seeking a grant. Instead, they're asking for one-time money to provide a 10-year low-interest loan. They will use this to finance business development in their respective regions. For 10 years, they will pay interest to the state, and after 10 years, they will repay the state funds, the funds loaned to them. And all the while, they will guarantee repayment of the state's loan. In guaranteeing the repayment of the state funds, they're asking for flexibility in how they administer their business financing activity. They may provide subordinated debt financing, low-interest financing. They may provide patient capital. Yeah, I was going to say patent capital. I can't read today. And with delayed repayment terms, or they may make equity positions in companies that show outstanding growth potential. This kind of flexibility is very important, and because of the loan function, I think you could see why giving them that would be a good thing. These are options that will be up to the foundations to consider as they frame their respective programs. Each foundation is slightly different, and they're likely to take a somewhat different path as each region has somewhat different business finance needs. I have three great people with me today. I have Kathy Galswick from the Central Minnesota Initiative Foundation to testify on behalf of the bill. With her is Chuck Hayes, who will be able to speak about the business role and the important role that the foundations play. And I also have Tom Rainier from the Northland Foundation to answer any other questions we might have.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome, everyone. If you would introduce yourselves for on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clark, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Galswick. I'm with the Initiative Foundation based in Little Falls, Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to present this legislation to you and are excited and looking forward to the possibility of, again, partnering with the state of Minnesota to do great things across the state. The six initiative foundations were created in 1986, as Senator Clark referenced, in partnership with the McKnight Foundation. So each one is a freestanding regional foundation with its own board and its own staff. We have a community and economic development mission. And in 1987, we actually received special IRS authorization to make business loans as a charitable activity, which is a real unique thing for foundations. And that's also the time then that we began our partnership with the state. Today, the collective assets of the six initiative foundations are around $275 million. And we have distributed about $250 million in the form of grants to not-for-profits and loans for business development. It's a unique model, doesn't exist anywhere else in the country or the world that we know of. And it's pretty amazing to me that nearly 21 years later, it's still going strong and making a difference across the state. Specifically, the collective impact of our business financing programs is noteworthy. Together, the six foundations have made loans to 2,600 businesses, totaling $150 million in investment, leveraging an additional $800 million in private investment and creating about 38,000 jobs. Our partnership with the state began, as we've mentioned, in 1987 when the Rural Development Act created the Challenge Grant Program, awarding $1 million to each of the six initiative foundations. Then in 1993, the legislature reauthorized that program and awarded an additional $6 million. In the year 2000, there was a rule change that allowed those revolved or repaid funds to remain with each of the initiative foundations, and they're continuing to work in business development. We provide annual reports to the state on our overall activity. Conservatively, I would say that initial $12 million that you've invested into our organizations has revolved two or three times, and virtually all of it is still working across the state. Collectively, our overall portfolios are now about $50 million in the business financing aspect of what we do, and that investment you made makes up about $12 million of that. The funding that we're asking you for now is needed for several reasons. First of all, we've seen a significant change in gap financing since we began this work 20 years ago. For example, our average loan size has increased from about $75,000 to about $200,000 per project, It takes more capital. Businesses have higher costs for equipment and technology. Some of the things we've been talking about here today with regard to alternative energy and biobusiness development, it's expensive business development work. And it's difficult for financial institutions to finance things like intellectual property and specialized equipment. It's not as hard and fast of a collateral as land and buildings. So we're finding that our role in those projects needs to be more significant. Also, our level of participation in individual projects has increased because there are fewer alternative lenders in Greater Minnesota. Some of the utilities, for example, are getting out of that business. In some parts of the state, we have fewer hometown banks because of mergers and acquisitions in the banking community. And also, some of the banks run into lending limits on these bigger projects, and they need another partner to be able to make those deals. And finally, as Senator Clark referenced, there's a greater demand for flexible capital that's adaptable to these new kinds of businesses that are being developed. And so we need that flexibility to make loans, microloans, equity or near equity investments. Sometimes we target our work by type of business, for example, alternative energy or biobusiness, or we might target specific geographic areas or try to find ways to support local strategies across the state. So in summary, we are asking for a loan, not a grant. This is a business-like approach for providing capital to rural entrepreneurs. We have a solid track record. Our performance demonstrates that the initiative foundations have the competence to make sound investments and yield high return. This will improve the health of Greater Minnesota communities. Making these business investments in the context of the other work that we do in community and economic development, whether it's grants or early childhood initiatives, other kinds of projects that we're working on, helps leaders make their communities strong and takes a broader approach to that. This investment would complement other economic development tools that the state has created that are available for communities to use, like JobZ and the Minnesota Investment Fund, the very important worker training programs, and other specialized or strategic initiatives that you're looking at. This kind of investment can work very well alongside those. And I would say finally that there's a double bottom line. If you make this loan to the six initiative foundations, we will repay it. We're prepared to fully guarantee repayment at the end of the 10 years. We'll make those interest payments. And at the same time, we're helping businesses, thereby increasing the economic vitality of rural communities. Helps those entrepreneurs stay in and invest in their small towns. The $12 million we're talking about or requesting would likely be invested within 2 or 3 years, leveraging another $50 or $60 million in investment, creating jobs, generating tax revenue in the communities, and bringing more activity to our local main streets and communities across the state. We respectfully request your support for this legislation and would look forward to answering questions in a few moments. But first, it's my pleasure to introduce Chuck Hayes. Chuck is Vice President for Organizational Performance at Sage Electrochromics in Faribault, Minnesota, and he'll share a few comments.
And thank you, Mr. Hayes, for being here today. You know, just the other day, I believe, we talked about another program, and could it be a loan program as opposed to an outright grant? And so this is very interesting to hear this and how the money keeps on, you know, producing new jobs in Minnesota. And just, I think, for members on one of the handouts regarding the loan stories, on page 2, it features a wind project. So I think that we're really on the same theme today. So thank you again, Mr. Hayes, for being here. And please introduce yourself.
I will. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Hayes, and I'm a vice president at Sage Electrochromics in Faribault, Minnesota. By way of introduction, Sage produces a new material technology called electrochromic glass. That's a mouthful, but it's a switchable glass technology. You've been for years able to tune the lighting in a room with a dimmer switch. You can now, with switchable glass, tune the solar glare and the solar heat gain of a window or a skylight. That's what Sage Electrochromics does in Faribault. And while that's a very convenient and comfortable technology, the real benefit, and it's funny we're talking about energy today, is that there's enormous energy savings through conservation by employing the technology. Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, along with the U.S. Department of Energy, did a multi-year study using prototype sage glass, and Lawrence Berkeley estimates that the average commercial building will be able to reduce its energy signature by 35 to 45% by employing switchable glazings. So we talked about the first 25% of renewable energy. We can, in the near future, talk about knocking off the second 25% with conservation technology. It's conservation technology that doesn't cause inconvenience or discomfort. It actually enhances comfort. But that's what SAGE does, and our technology is important to the energy debate going on in our country today. SAGE did not start in Minnesota. SAGE incubated at Rutgers University Center of Ceramic Research in New Jersey, and that incubation started in 1989 and completed there in 1998. That's not uncommon for new emerging technologies. New material science technologies often take a decade or two to come out of the lab. But SAGE moved to Minnesota in 1999 because SAGE viewed Minnesota as a Silicon Valley of the window industry. When you look at the companies that developed and pushed low-E glass, the current standard today, into the marketplace, most of those companies are centered here. SAGE felt the best opportunity to get the technology out of the lab and on the factory floor was to bring the technology to Minnesota. SAGE moved here in 99 with the help of the initiative, established a pilot line in a rented facility with rented equipment down in Faribault. Purpose of that pilot line was not to produce a lot of glass. It was to figure out how to produce it, get it out of the lab, get it on the factory floor, and figure out how to scale it. That work was completed in 2004. In late 2004 and 2005, we constructed our first production facility. You'll see that on I-35 as you approach Faribault, just on the north edge of the city limits. It's a 60,000-square-foot facility, state-of-the-art manufacturing, we started shipping our first quantities of commercial quantities of glass exactly a year ago yesterday, so February of 2006. The reason I'm here today is that the Southern Minnesota Initiative provided critical early-stage funding to help SAGE get from New Jersey to Minnesota and get the pilot line up and running. SAGE leveraged that investment, and that initial investment was around $100,000. SAGE leveraged that investment. Today, SAGE has over $45 million of investment. But that early critical seed funding was important. When you're a pre-revenue company, banks don't talk to you yet. You have to start somewhere. Most new technologies never get out of the lab. Initiative was very critical to allowing SAGE to get to the pilot line and then leveraging the success of the pilot line to actually get to production. What that means today, just in terms of jobs, when SAGE moved here, it was 8 employees. 2 weeks ago, I hired the 50th employee at SAGE. And those jobs are not minimum wage jobs. The 28 positions we've added in 2005 and 2006 had an average wage of over $67,000. The lowest full-time position we've added was at $36,500. And you can own a house and a car today for $36,500 in Faribault. Most of the jobs were well above that. Unfortunately, we are a nation of investors that look for returns on investment in 90 days or less. And that's why a lot of technologies like SAGE never get out of the lab. But for success stories like SAGE to get out of the lab, investments like the Initiative Fund are just critical. And so I will just tell you, it is a good investment by the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Another great story. And we have a third person here to testify.
Madam Chair.
I'm Senator Jay.
I know time is of the essence. All I want to say is not only is this a good program, but this is a wonderful company. They're in my district, and they do wonderful things for our community after they've been there. And I'm glad they're having great success.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Rainier is here to answer questions. He doesn't need to answer.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, on line 2.5, it says the state investment is by the commissioner in any eligible organization may not exceed $2 million. Why would you get less than $2 million? I don't know if it's, I mean, is there a...
And, Ms., if you can introduce yourself for the record, just...
I'm Tom Rainier. I'm the president of the Northland Foundation in Duluth. Senator Tomasoni,
When we wrote this, we wanted to make sure that we gave the option to our colleagues to ramp this up over a period of time. But in talking to all of them, the demand on our capital is such that I have no doubt that each of us will, in fact, engage the whole $2 million, and probably relatively quickly. Speaking on our part, if it's possible to close a loan with Deed in the state of Minnesota on July 1st for the entire $2 million, the Northland Foundation intends to do that. We have huge demands on our capital, and there's businesses out there that are not going to get financed if we don't take advantage of this.
And Madam Chair, then you're intending this to be a revolving loan fund and paying it back to the state after 10 years. But
correct.
Why wouldn't we just allow you to keep revolving it?
Well, in effect, if we asked for that 10 years in advance, we'd be asking for a grant. This is really, as Kathy Goldswick said, this is really the new way for community development organizations to finance loan funds. You know, who can predict 10 years down the road? But if this comes back to the state, it's really your call, it's Deed's call, if they would want to recycle it through us or through other organizations. I would hope that the money coming back to the state would continue to be used in some form or fashion to finance rural businesses. But we felt that we're in a position to guarantee repayment of a loan. It seems like a better opportunity for the state to make an investment and get a guaranteed return on that investment. It's not really our point to say, here's what you need to do at the end of 10 years. We're more than happy to pay it back. That money will be leveraged, as Kathy said, many times over during that 10-year period.
Are there other questions?
No, I'm just thinking that as long as they're paying it back, they're going to be paying the money back to you, and then you'll be loaning it out again.
Well,
and Mr. Rainier.
And I'm just thinking you might as well just keep doing it.
Well, we will keep doing it. I mean, that's the business we're in. Our typical term on a loan for a new business or a business expansion is about 7 years. That's kind of a business cycle where businesses turn the corner and become totally bankable. So this $2 million, if we were to engage it, if we were to borrow it all on July 1st, it would probably take us between 18 months and 2 years to get it all out and invested in businesses, and it'll turn over 1 to 2 times during that 10-year period. So in that sense, internally in our organization, it revolves. It's going to revolve once back to the state, and that's at the end of 10 years. And it will have done what it was intended to do. So I guess it's just not our – we feel it would be presumptuous on our part to say, well, just keep it going and keep it going, because then it would, in effect, be a grant, asking for a grant. And I know that you folks in your committees have plenty of pressure to spend money and to make grants. We're in a position not to ask for a grant, so we felt it was appropriate to ask for a loan.
Any other questions? And to Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who would like to answer that, but this is essentially a unsecured loan.
To Mr. Rainier. Looks like he's ready to answer.
It's essentially unsecured. We're in a position to secure it in any way that Deed writes the rules. The fact is we have the wherewithal. We could put up our loan portfolio against it. We've borrowed money from the federal government. This is actually modeled after a program that USDA has right now. And most of us, if not all of us, have taken advantage of that. And essentially the same kind of terms. And we guarantee those loans to the federal government with our entire loan portfolio. There's enough assets there to make sure that that's but in terms of a securitizing the loan, I guess I leave that up to the rulemakers. But we're in a position to do that, certainly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Other questions? Is there a motion to forward this to the Finance Committee to approve it? And for Senator Rosen moves that this will be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 And opposed? And the motion passes. Yes.
Thank you.
And next on our agenda today is Senator Dibble here.
We're still waiting for Senator Dibble.
Okay. Would we like to start? Senator Dahl is here with his bill. Would you like to come forward, Senator Dahl, with Senate File 563, Renewable Energy Objective State Economic Benefit Strategy. And in looking over this, Senator Dahl, I think this is the roadmap or perhaps the business plan that we've been talking about earlier today, if I read it right. But we'll hear from you on this bill. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. It's the business plan that we're looking for, and I've brought a couple of testifiers with me to kind of highlight some of the benefits we see happening. Mr. Mike Bull and Mr. George Crocker with me. It's Senate File 563 is a pretty simple bill, but it's very critical to the next step on the renewable energy standard, that economic development that we want to see captured from us moving into this new era with green industry, and how we can build the different segments, whether that be in the ownership portion of the wind energy or maybe even other fuel sources, as well as into manufacturing and support services around the state. So I'll leave this to my testifiers to kind of highlight how they see this working.
Thank you. And let's see, Mr. Bull is here from the Department of Commerce. And welcome back to the table.
Would you like to introduce
yourself again and tell us a little bit about Senate File 563.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Bull. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. My testimony on Senate File 563 is similar to what I said earlier in sort of overview comments, that this kind of comprehensive analysis touching on everything from manufacturing through local ownership of energy production, like we have down in our area, Senator Day. I'm down from Northfield, just a little bit north of you. From maintenance on energy production facilities, the service on those facilities, the construction of those facilities, looking at the benefits that we can extract from this renewable energy standard that you all just passed and the governor signed, that this is what's going to make this it's good to have the most aggressive renewable energy standard in the country. I think that's a good thing on its face, as to the extent that we make sure that our customers are protected from negative impacts, but also the real benefit, I think, will come maybe from the work that we'll be doing through Senate File 563, making sure we capture the full benefits of the renewable energy standard for the citizens of Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, one thing I wanted to point out, DEED is here. DEED is the primary state agency that will be conducting some of the work. I'll be working very closely with those folks and wanted to mention that the agency believes that we can do this without an additional appropriation.
We'd like to hear that. And do we have someone else here to testify today, Senator Dahl?
Yes, Mr. George Crocker.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's truly an honor to be here. For the record, Senator Saltzman is my senator, and I am truly pleased to have this opportunity to testify before this committee on this really, really exciting. I share the chairman's excitement about the opportunity that we have if we get it right. And that's the real key, because what we've done to point here so far has been an exercise in political democracy to make a commitment to an energy future that makes sense for our children and their children as we move forward in time. From an environmental perspective, I can think it would be fair to say that that's what's been driving that renewable energy commitment. It's because of the acid rain and the global warming and the mercury and the fish and the nuclear waste and the particulate contamination, and I can go on and on and on. But it's those kinds of impacts that are eroding the ecological foundation that we all rely upon to sustain ourselves that is driving us in a political setting to move. But I would submit that that political effort will fail unless we also understand the concept of economic democracy. That's what will allow us to be successful, when we learn how we all have an equity share in the development that we've made the political commitment to. Economic democracy is the drive word that will enable this to be successful. And toward that end, this bill provides the oversight. It provides the guidance that will enable us to pursue that economic democracy towards the kind of development that Senator Metzen and others were talking about. And I would submit that the development for the turbine manufacturing, you know, maybe the range is a good place for it. But maybe
no buts.
But maybe the Ford plant is a good place for it too.
And the Ford,
right?
Plant.
So there's an and in there with it. There's a lot of really remarkable economic development that can happen if we get it right, if we understand what economic democracy means as a driving engine behind our political commitment to renewable energy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You know, I think it's exciting to have people here who have the vision, because that's what's going to drive this, is people who can see where this can go, sell it to the rest of us, because I think you have just really highlighted what's so important here, is that we've taken an issue that has really been driven by people concerned about the environment, but now to see the economic impact of that for Minnesota is what is truly exciting, especially for this committee. So are there any questions for
Madam Chair,
Senator Dahl?
I do have an amendment I would like to add to this to kind of clean up the language a little bit, if I may. It's the A2 amendment being passed around, basically just to add an effective date to the language.
Chair, I'd like to move that amendment.
And Senator Rosen has moved the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is passed. Senator Metzen.
I have an amendment, too.
Yes. Senator Metzen.
Madam Chair, if I may, it's very important amendment. It extends the life of the Electric Energy Task Force, which
he's already adopted this one.
I guess it technically expires, so I do good things. I just have to get it.
Thank you.
Everybody, I think that's ever served on it, or at least the folks at the front desk know that it works very well, and quite frankly, it's funded by XL Energy, so it's kind of, you know, taxpayers in a sense, but it's not a big number, but the committee does good work, so that's what this amendment does.
All right. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? Okay, Senator Dahl, do you want to comment on the amendment?
I don't have any objections to the amendment as well.
Very good. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Madam Chair, then to piggyback, if that passed, then I wanted to add the A3 amendment that just kind of clarifies a little bit more what the group does. The Legislative Electric Energy Task Force shall provide legislative oversight on the strategy and monitor its implementation. So that kind of ties in, I think, with this bill that Senator Dahl has and the next bill coming forward, and what the people talked about a little earlier today. So it just kind of all fits in the big puzzle, I believe.
Very good. Any discussion on the A3 amendment? And Senator Dahl, do you want to comment on the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, this legislative, the task force, it shall provide legislative oversight on the strategy. Is that they're going to be the guiding forces that you see with this?
We just, Madam Chair, overseeing it.
Senator Metzen.
No, we have nothing, just looking at it. Another pair of eyes, so to speak. So, and Mr. Bull, is that how you? The reason I call him Mr. Bull is that he and I have worked on this stuff together for the last, and Mr. Crocker for, 12 years now. And so we are, that's why I look to them for their advice, too, on some of this stuff. And they've been around it a long time and know what we're trying to do here.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, I think this is a good idea. It sort of closes the loop. The work that we'll be doing with DEED under Dribble. Senator Dahl's bill will, it's an agency. It's being directed by the legislature. It's an agency activity. Will be coming back, and it helps to have that legislative guidance as we work through this.
Mr. Crocker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, would really support this amendment. I think that the Legislative Energy Task Force, in its history, has struggled a bit with what its mission was and what really was the objective that it was reaching toward. And I think now we have clarified our vision enough so that we can really profit from the type of leadership towards that vision that a really engaged legislative energy task force could provide. So the time is very ripe for this amendment.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion on the A3 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? And amendment passes. We also have someone who would like to testify, Reese Ledger, who is with the Teamsters Local 120. Thank you for coming, Mr. Ledger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Reese Ledger. I am the Strategic Campaigns Director of Teamsters Local 120, which has over 11,000 members and is the largest of its kind in the state. I'm here to express support for SF-563. The bold investment that Minnesota intends on making in renewable energy will require strategic planning to benefit the state. This bill will begin the process of formulating short and long-term strategies to maximize the value of renewable energy. However, SF-563 overlooks an inconvenient truth and ignores our nation's most important renewable resource, the American worker. Too often, employers that benefit from billions of dollars in federal and state tax incentives disregard the responsibility to create quality jobs and respect labor laws. Unfortunately, employers like DMI Industries, a subsidiary of Otter Tail Energy, that manufactures bases for wind turbines, are more concerned with their bottom lines than the safety and well-being of their workers. While more than willing to benefit from government subsidies, they repeatedly disregard laws governing everything from occupational safety to gender discrimination to union organizing. 200 workers at DMI Industries grew weary of working with respiration masks, ventilation systems, and welding hoods that were inadequate or in disrepair. They grew tired of working 12 to 14-hour days, day in and day out, because the company refused to hire an adequate number of workers to keep up with record demand. Quite simply, they wanted to both put in a hard day's work and safely return home with time for their families. They decided to organize a union with Teamsters Local 120. DMI Industries responded by hiring Behrens & Tate, a notorious union-busting law firm. In short order, workers were forced to attend captive audience meetings where they were subjected to hours of anti-union propaganda. More union busting, ranging from illegal firings to worker interrogations, are likely to follow if the past is any indication. SF-563, as currently written, does not include consideration of job quality and workers' rights as part of the strategic planning process. Renewable energy can be a lifeline to workers who once built everything from armaments to adhesive tape to automobiles in Minnesota. Teamsters Local 120 urges the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development and others to consider labor issues in formulating strategy so that the state's investment in renewable energy is also an investment in creating good middle-class jobs. Thank you.
And that was this particular bill is to develop the strategy, and I think you've raised some issues with that. But to come back to this bill, I think that really we will be talking about recommendations to the legislature, and those are good points to keep in mind. So thank you for bringing them to our attention today.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Is there any other discussion on Senate File 563?
Madam Chair.
And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to ask a question to Mr. Bull.
Mr. Bull. So don't leave the table too fast.
And perhaps I should direct the question to DEED, but they have a biz-friendly program? Are we going to include something like that in this whole strategy of biz-friendly in the renewable energy push?
And Mr. Bolt.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think that's a very good idea. The biz nice or biz friendly.
That's
I can't
what it
remember,
is. Biz nice. Whatever. Mm-hmm.
Is a program at DEED for one stop permitting, a state permitting from environmental permits and licenses and such. And so I think to the extent that we need to make sure that we have the appropriate speed of licensing and permitting of projects to get them up and running, I think expanding and looking at the BizNice program for permitting, I think that's a very good idea.
Excellent point, Senator Rosen. Any other discussion before we vote? All right. Senator Bonoff, would you move Senate File 563? Yes. And all those in favor? Is there any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And the bill passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Some of these, like I mentioned about an hour ago or so, kind of piggyback on one another, and this is, I believe, educational part and retraining, if you will,
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The bigger bill, the 2025 bill, and because we have to train people if we're going.
Right.
So it's similar to even the last one, but Senator, we've only got a couple, 2-3 minutes, so
all right,
Senator Dibble, welcome.
We can go as fast as you need, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your indulgence. Thanks to the committee. Senate File 1277 seeks to it's very similar in spirit to the last bill, and I think you've had several other bills that are similar. So you know, everyone's kind of having the similar idea at the same time. That's coming out of the exciting energy future that we're contemplating. And what this bill, Mr. Chair and members, asked to do is that we take a look as a state at what the workforce needs are going to be in a renewable energy future with different kinds of technologies. You see, there's a handout coming around about a Bachelor of Science program that's been developed at Oregon Tech. It's designed to train in the workforce of the future in implementation and research and development of renewable energy technologies. With your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bernstein is here with us. They're a friend of mine and former commissioner.
If my witnesses can keep their comments to about 15 seconds each, maybe if we can hear from them.
18 seconds each.
Senator Metzen, it's good to be back in front of your committee. I don't think I've ever done anything in 18 seconds, however. But this time I promise I'll
You're
do
good
it.
At today.
I hear you, Senator. On behalf of the two-year technical colleges are very interested in this legislation because, as many of you know, the technical colleges, to be able to produce workers and graduates for this brand-new industry, we need to know what the employment prospects are, what the availability of students is, what kinds of coursework they're going to need, and how many graduates we're going to need in the state of Minnesota. We can't do new programs until we know these answers, and that's what this bill is all about. 18 seconds, Senator. Thank you.
Very good. Very good. Sir, did you wish to have your 12 seconds? He took 6 years.
Chair, this is Brad Von Bank. And Brad and Frank Jossi here are coming out of the Humphrey Institute. They're policy fellows at the Humphrey Institute. And this is their capstone project. This is coming out of
Welcome.
Their work.
Thank you. I'm the vice president at General Electric, but I'm really here as a fellow. And specifically, the role that I've played is to do some focus groups in the private sector to start unearthing the need or the demand for employment, and have spoken very specifically with companies like GE Wind, with Blattner, with Mortenson, and GE Commercial Finance, Fleet Services, all of whom have very specifically said that there are jobs that they need. There are jobs that they currently have that simply require retraining. They're not exactly sure what those look like, but the idea of nesting in some sort of certification, two-year associate programs inside of a four-year degree, not only gives them immediate, well-trained employees, but also career pathing that they don't have today as those careers evolve.
Mr. Chair, this is Frank Jossi.
Hi, I'm Frank Jossi. I'll just be also brief. I'm a journalist, and for the last several months and for the last decade, I've written about renewable energy. And for I've talked to a lot of people in the field, and as Brad mentioned, after the interviews, I often go, so what are the job prospects for you? What are you looking at 2 years out? Are you going to hire anybody? How many people are you going to hire? Almost to the person, they've said they're going to hire many people, including Mortensen has just started a ethanol development wing. They're going to start looking for employees. So I think this is all anecdotal. We could use a professionally done study and begin to lay the groundwork for a renewable energy future for the state. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
How come we always this is a good idea. We're going to pass it. But why do we always need more money? I mean, can't you just tell the department once in a while to do something? Or you know what I'm saying? And I'm not the biggest conservative in the world, but every time we ask the department that's an existing department with hundreds of staff people, can't you do something? No, we need $182,000 more for – but that's Senator Saltzman.
Yes. On that point, Mr. Chair, you know, I also see this as higher ed, but it really has to do with our K-12 schools as well, because we're looking at our higher standards in math and science, and we have to grab the kids when they're in high school. So if they go to higher ed and they don't start taking some of these technical areas, so I think that it may be something to look at, too. Where is our Department of Education at in this? Because it makes the case of what drives our curriculum and where we need to invest from, you know, early childhood all the way up to our higher ed institutions. So
that's probably good.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, yes, at Minsky, and I work with a program at Anoka Technical College that does exactly that. It's a secondary tech ed program where we take students from high school. They're actually at the college. Northeast is looking at it. Rochester is looking at it, and St. Paul also. So we have those kinds of things ongoing. In response to Senator Metzen's question, the reason for the money is Jack Geller at the Center for Rural Policy is going to be the one conducting it. The center is going to conduct the study in conjunction with University of Minnesota and or Minsky. That decision will be made. But the fact of the matter is that people get paid for doing these kinds of studies.
So it does involve Outsider and some other. Yes, all right, let's move the bill. Senator Day moves that Senate File 1277 be recommended to pass and forward it to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Good meeting today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.
Wonderful meeting.
best ever.